Happy Thursday and welcome back to Farewell, listeners. Joined by Brad Stahlberg and Steve Magnus, I'm Clay Skipper. But I'm sure you know that already. If you're a new listener, maybe you don't know that, welcome. Glad to have you. Great news. Money talks. At the end of the last roundtable, I pointed out that even though we have a voicemail, it has received very little action. And I offered up a $20 incentive to listeners if they called into the voicemail. And guess what, guys? The voicemails have been absolutely rolling in. So that's exciting for us. I also want to say,
are you in the whole $400 now, Clay?
Well, hang on. What I said, and people were listening because they called, was that I would offer up $20 if the question made it into the show. So I'm in the hole for, I guess, $60 because we're using three questions today.
Clay, it's like no more voicemails in the show. No more voicemails in the show.
The voicemails were great. They were very, very much appreciated. They were from a wide swath of listeners all over the country. A few people called me while running, which I really appreciated. Felt like they were living out the growth equation principles as they were ingesting the podcast and then calling in. And people were just very kind and said a lot of nice things about what we're doing, which I really appreciate. And I also just appreciate the engagement and the thoughtful questions. So even if your question doesn't make it in today, thank you for calling. And we really very much appreciate it. So we're going to start with Oliver from Burlington, who had a question. Congrats, Oliver. You're $20 richer. I will text you and get your Venmo. Who had a question about when training can become unhealthy. There were parts of his voicemail I couldn't quite understand, but I think what he was saying was that he runs to be healthy. And for him, it sounds like that is running six days a week at about 70 miles, which that is pretty, pretty high for, I guess I would use the category civilian runner here. Steve is throwing his hands up in triumph. He's wondering if he should push into triple digits to try to be an elite runner. And I thought this is something we could zoom out into a larger conversation because we talk a lot about like the minimum amount people should be moving their bodies to be healthy. But we don't always talk about the like when a relationship to exercise can become unhealthy. And I'm also thinking about this because I was just reading Leslie Jameson's great book, The Recovering, which is about her struggle with alcoholism, and just made me think about different addictions, different types of addictions, and which ones are more normalized in society and which ones are less so. And exercise, I think, is an addiction that we often valorize in society. It doesn't just have to be exercise. It could be, you know, workaholism. That's another addiction in society that we often normalize. So yeah, I would just zoom out and say, how do you guys think about what is a healthy relationship to exercise or something that's even put in the bucket of like a quote unquote good addiction? And hopefully that can help answer Oliver's question as well.
All right, Oliver, thank you. This is a really good question. So I want to start by saying, I don't think there is such a thing as a good addiction. By definition, addiction is the continued use of a substance or repetition of a behavior despite negative consequences. And I would say that it's despite negative consequences that outweigh its positive benefits. So I think the first part of this is separating a habit or something that you go all in on from an addiction. And I think a big part of the tipping point is when a habit or when something you go all in on becomes an addiction, meaning the cost-benefit ratio of doing it tips to be negative. Whether or not something slips into addiction territory is very much contextual. So I wrote about this in Master of Change, but oftentimes what happens is when people experience big disruptions in their life, they are prone to addiction. And that's when many people develop substance use disorders as well as behavioral addictions. And in the ultra running community, though there's no data on this, anecdotally, it seems everybody is one degree removed from someone in their ultra running community that is in recovery for alcoholism, for opioids, for cocaine, for methamphetamine, you name it. And what I would say is that if ultra running is replacing cocaine or heroin or methamphetamines, then it is unquestionably a healthy choice. Now, that might be in the short term, but in the long term, if ultra running, if you get over that other addiction and ultra running starts to bring all these negative consequences to one's life, that it begins to outweigh the benefits, but you can't step away from it, you can't stop, then I think that starts to flirt with addiction.
It's all relative, which I think is really important here. Meaning, from my own life, when I was running 110, 120 miles a week, 90 felt like nothing. When I was running 100 miles a week, 70 felt like nothing. And I think this is really important here because, like, to me, when we look at, you know, how much is someone doing the thing isn't the real answer. It's like the underlying, do you feel a compulsion to do the thing, or do you want to do the thing? And I think that is like a really clear distinguisher. So I kind of see it through a lens of, you know, to me is less so of like positive or negative, but more so of like, do I have the power to have like just a little space in there, or do I not? Because if you look at, for instance, the running example of, you know, when does exercise become an addiction to me? Well, to me, it's when like I'm so committed to the thing that even when like it is better for my performance, my livelihood, my goals, my outcomes, I don't take that path. So for instance, for Oliver, if he wants to be good, and he says, you know what? I want to throw caution to wind and see how good I can be. And he smartly ramps it up to 100 miles a week and starts seeing improvements and it gets better. To me, that's fine, right? It's not addictive behavior in a negative sense. But if he starts doing that and all the signs are pointing to Oliver, you are overtraining like hell and like injuries are popping up and your performance is going the wrong direction, then that tells me he's doing it to feel like the compulsion to do it, if that makes sense. So we'll set that aside as Brad's shaking his head. We'll cover this before he comes in. Go ahead, Brad, shake your head.
All right. I have some disagreements here. This would be good. And it could just be the terms we're using, but there could be some real significance there. The first is, I think that you are essentially describing the psychological variety of doing something despite negative consequences. So if Oliver keeps running because he's compelled to and he can't stop and it hurts his performance, he's doing it despite negative consequences. If he keeps running despite a stress fracture in his fourth metatarsal, he's running despite negative consequences. So I really think it's a pretty easy heuristic for defining addiction. Now, I think where things get harder is when the negative consequences aren't in the pursuit itself. In delineating between trade-offs and negative consequences. So let's make this really real. I'm not going to use Oliver's name because we don't know anything about Oliver other than he's a much better runner than me and a fan of the growth equation. So let's just make up the name Amy. And let's assume that Amy is in a similar situation as Oliver. And Amy takes her mileage up from 70 to 100 miles a week. And she's not physically getting injured. But the person that she's been dating starts to feel neglected because Amy is just spending all this time running and now Amy is way too tired to do anything else. And when Amy travels, some of her friends are like, Amy, why are you like having to prioritize running for 2 hours a day when we're on this vacation? And at work, maybe Amy's performance starts to suffer a little bit. Now, on its face, you could say, Amy shouldn't be running 100 miles a week, but I completely disagree because it's cost benefit. I think Amy would have to ask herself, what am I getting out of running? And if what I am getting out of running is more positive than the relationship with my boyfriend or girlfriend, than the good status at my job, maybe I'll make new friends in the running community that live a similar lifestyle to me, then I think it's a net positive. But I do think that like, it's easy to be like, yeah, if you're running 100 miles a week despite getting injured, that's an addiction. It's harder to say if you're running 100 miles a week and it's having negative effects elsewhere in your life, what do you do? And that I really think is about confronting trade-offs that come with pursuing excellence, mastery, peak performance in whatever it is that you do. There's this fame. Let me say one last thing. There's this famous. Well, I don't know. It's not famous actually. It's famous in my brain because I always think about it, which is Jonathan Franzen, who's one of the great American novelists of this generation. His agent essentially told him, "You can't have kids because you'd be a worse novelist." And I don't know if there's truth to this, but I've read multiple profiles of Franzen, which essentially said Franzen decided not to have kids because it would make him a worse novelist. Now, that is the kind of big trade-offs that come when you're truly pursuing excellence. One person might say that's an insane addiction. Another person might say that's dedication to craft.
Yeah, I don't think we're in, I'm not sure where we're in disagreement here, Brad. I think that's like, it's making a choice. And I would still say that, like, you know, we're splitting hairs on whether we call it addiction or not.
But no, where we disagree, I think, and I didn't get there yet, is the compulsion part, Steve, because I think that often like great art or like great craftspersonship comes out of a compulsion to do the thing. It's like the feeling that if, I mean, you said it yourself, you recently, maybe it was even on this podcast, you said the only reason someone should write a book is if they feel like they have to, if like they can't live without writing the book. I mean, that sounds like compulsion to me.
But I don't think that's that's what I mean. There's no difference between like the underlying thing that produces like negative addiction and positive compulsion are the same thing from a biological standpoint. It's dopamine,
didn't you just
serotonin,
say you're, didn't,
now,
yeah,
all
no,
that
I
stuff.
Get all that. But didn't you just say that you're one of the ways you define addiction is if like you're compelled to do it?
Well, there's like, if there's a underlying compulsion addiction, yes. But I think what we're getting at here is that the point I'm trying to make is it doesn't have to be a negative thing. There doesn't have to be negative consequences to be addicted. So for instance,
then we are just splitting hairs because I would argue that what you're saying is falling in love. Like,
yeah,
to me,
it's all the same stuff.
The flip side of addiction is falling in love, except addiction is negative consequences and love is on balance positive consequences.
See, yeah. So we're still
so Oliver. Hairs. So Oliver is either getting addicted to running or falling in love with running to the next level. And it's solely based on the consequences it has on his mind, body, and emotional and physical health, right?
But I don't think it's necessarily consequences on that. I think it's just kind of given the situation and what he's kind of wanting out of it. Because we could say love is also a negative consequences if in the, like it can go that pathway as well.
I think it goes back to what you said, Brad, which is about trade-offs. Because really what this gets at is something we say often, or that I've started to say often after being with you guys who say it often, but it's made me realize it's true, is like, what are your values, right? And how are the things that you, the activities you're doing in your life, how do they reflect what you value? Because I can speak to this somewhat. I feel like I'm at an interesting spot with running where I did have a major life disruption. I got laid off. 2 years ago or a year and a half ago. And I got, it was after that, that I got like super into running and have been pretty, I mean, running is very joyful for me and I do want to do it, but I've been pretty compulsive in how I run and I'm like trying to get better and getting better. And this weekend I'm running a half and I'm trying to run it the fastest I've ever run it. And a question that's been looming for me is, it's somewhat similar to Oliver, is like, if I hit my goal this weekend, will I finally be able to be like, all right, cool? Because after I hit my goal last time I ran a marathon, I was like, I'm done. If I break 3 hours, I'm done. But now I did it. And so I want to get better and better. But I, in the back of my mind is a question of like, when is this going to be enough? And how is this chase for getting faster and faster and trying to find my upper limit, how is that influencing other aspects of my life? I have less energy to do work. I have less time to do work. And again, it goes back to this idea of like a trade-off and what is enough and what matters to you.
I think this comes back to what Brad calls trade-off. I call like being able to choose the thing.
Yeah.
Or having some semblance of choosing, because like this is natural. This is striving, right?
Yeah.
And the answer to your question is nothing will ever be enough. I mean, that's the answer. I mean, if it's in our biology, if we were programmed to be, you know, content, like we wouldn't go out and get the, you know, the food or hunt the next lion or whatever the hell we're going to do. Like we're programmed for the chase, not the contentment. Like, it's pretty clear biologically. So, like, to me, it comes back to, you know, as Brad said, trade-offs, as I would say, like choosing, like, can you stick your head above water and does this still align with what you want to do? And I think this is the key there, is like that compulsion, especially if it's something that is meaningful and you care about, such as, you know, running in this case has meaning. It's something you care about. If there's natural to have that compulsion, but if you can pop your head above water at different times of your life and say, hey, it makes total sense to go all in here. It makes total sense to strive to go faster. It makes total sense to run 100 miles a week, 110 miles a week, whatever that is. I think the key is, like, do you have the ability at some point, and this is really hard, and this is where it kind of goes into that negative consequences, negative addiction. Do you have the ability when it stops aligning with your values, or your values change or priorities change? I think that's a big part of it.
I go back to something Courtney said, which is like, keep Courtney DeWalter on one of our earlier episodes, keep joy in the front seat. And that's very much the case for me with running. This is the first training cycle where, like, I've had some nagging injuries. My back is hurting. My Achilles is hurting. And so in my mind, I'm like, if that keeps up, like, I care too much about movement. That's such like a lifelong practice of movement that I think I'm probably will do enough running to stay. Like, if someone's like, yo, you want to go on a 10 mile run, I can do it with them and not hold them back. And that'll become my new sort of barometer. Now, that's easy to say while I'm still progressing towards the upper limit. You know, like, I think it's going to be really hard if I run a great race this weekend to be like, dial it back and say, this is enough, you know, and I've done enough. But I think for me, it'll always be a question. And maybe, again, to bring it back to Oliver, and maybe this is a way of answering his question of like doing that sort of balance in your brain of like, what do I care about and what's important to me? And is running still serving that purpose? And as long as it is, that's great. And if that works at 70 miles and then you go to 100 miles and you realize that's no longer serving the things you want out of life or not getting you where you want to be, then maybe that's not, you know, being elite is not worth it in that case. So,
Yep. It's a net value equation. What's the benefit from making the jump? And that could be very real. What are the cost? And that could be very real. And where does the scale tip?
Completely. And I think, you know, the quote you gave from Courtney DeWalter, keeping joy in the front seat is it. 'Cause if I think back to my experiences as a running addict at various points in my life, I would say the difference wasn't how much miles I was running. It was whether it was like still a joyful activity. So I can think of times when I was like cranking 100 plus miles in the heat and humidity of Houston and was kind of miserable, but it was a hell of a lot of fun because I was like enjoying the process, doing it with friends, like took it seriously, but didn't take myself too seriously, you know? And then I think of other times when I was doing the same exact training, but it kind of became something that lacked joy, you know, for a variety of reasons. So I think that kind of is a good barometer, instead of seeing it as like, you know, is it the volume or amount of time I'm doing this thing? But is it still bringing joy, and is it doing so in a way that doesn't take away from everything else or take away from other things that are meaningful in my life? And if you're doing that, I think you're in a good spot.
So two more voicemails. We'll see if we make it through both of them. This one comes from Alex from San Francisco. Alex was responding to our last podcast episode about VO2 max and other things you don't need to know and how fitness has become overcomplicated. And he was curious what we thought about people who gamify exercise. So, you know, that could be like a 30-day challenge, or it could be trying to extend a streak as your motivation for getting out the door. And he was curious specifically if there are like psychological downsides to that type of approach that becomes more about extending that number on the streak as opposed to, you know, maybe doing the exercise for intrinsic reasons.
So my instinct here is twofold. Is first, whatever gets people out the door is a good thing. So if gamifying the thing is what gets you out the door, great. And that's like, if you didn't have that gamification, like you're not going to exercise or you're not going to move, then by all means, start by gamifying. But I would say use it to get started. But if you have to rely on that, then it's going to fail at some point, or you're going to quit the thing, because, like, you know, you can't play the game forever and it keep you engaged. I mean, we just spent a whole long time talking about joy and love of running or sport. We didn't talk about how, you know, you got a special star when you reached your 60th day in a row of running or whatever have you. So what I would say, again, is like, use that to get started, but there is a negative downside. What is that negative downside? It puts the point, it puts the motivator on the thing, meaning the reward, the number, the shiny object or thing that you get or feeling you get from running 80 days in a row or doing your 30-day hard or whatever it is. So somehow you have to move off of that. And how do you move off of that? I'd call it moving from like gamifying it to maybe something more akin to play. Although when we go run and exercise or move, we're not exactly playing, but it kind of is, because it's like we feel good about it. We're kind of exploring our fitness. We're exploring where we're at. We're not like, you know, doing it just to hit some standard or number or get our watch to tell us we're pretty good. So that's kind of how I would delineate it.
I was just jotting down some notes while Steve was talking, and I'm going to summarize what I say with, if it's working, then keep doing it. And if it's getting in your way, stop. And I think Steve just kind of unpacked some of the nuance and particulars with that. But it's a tool. It's no different than any other kind of fitness device or tracker or temptation bundling, which is this idea of, you know, if you really struggle to start any exercise program, you allow yourself to listen to like a trashy novel whenever you go to the gym, or listen to our podcast whenever you go to the gym. And therefore you're more likely to go to the gym. It's a great tool to get you in the gym, because more is better. And eventually probably starts to get in the way. If you really like training, you're going to want to pay close attention to your workout. Instead of having your headphones on, you're going to want to talk to the other people in the gym. And then you set the tool down. So, yep, psychological flexibility, I believe, is the fancy word for that.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that I think of here is, if you start optimizing for a streak or something, does that value or metric then become opposed to the sort of reason that you were doing the exercise in the first place? So that was a lot of words, but let me explain what I mean. This happened to me when I first started meditating. I had Headspace, and, you know, they're very good there of like, they have, you know, you've meditated 5 days in a row, you've meditated 10 days in a row. And I got really addicted to this. We keep saying addicted, but in this sense, I actually used it too cavalierly. So I'm going to say not addicted, but I really wanted to continue the streak. And I got to a point where I was like, every morning I'd be like, man, I don't have any time to do my meditation. And I'd be like frustrated and angry. And then I would realize like the point, as much as there is a point in meditation, is not to be good at sitting down and do that every day for 10 minutes. Like, the point of meditation is to like practice being with your thoughts and allowing things, so that when you are off the mat and not meditating, that can help you in life. And I was like, the streak, it's actually working against why I wanted to do this in the first place. And so that was a way that I was like, okay, the streak is not serving me. I should just meditate and not be getting angry and frustrated that I can't fit it in, so that I continue the streak, which is ultimately a meaningless number.
You know, I think that on balance, and of course there are exceptions, but on balance, things like streaks in very objective metrics and goals work really, really well when you're a novice at something, and maybe even intermediate. But as you get better, they often are constraining or work against the fundamental point of what you're trying to do.
Yeah.
So go to the gym 3 days a week. Deadlift my body weight. Run 20 miles a week. Read 25 minutes a day. Those are all great goals to get into strength training, running, being a regular reader. But eventually, those goals are just going to be way too narrow and constraining. And then the goal becomes run as fast as possible, be as strong as possible. develop my curiosity and intellect through reading. And the same person would benefit from both the specificity of like a streak, and then later on in their journey, they might need to release from it. So maybe another way to think of it is like early on in an activity or pursuit, something you're new to, you might need a little bit of extra motivation and some extra visible progress. So yeah, they can be really helpful. And then as you progress, you might have to let go of them.
All right, one more voicemail. This is, we actually had several voicemails about aging and how to exercise as we age. This one comes from Jeff from Columbus, Ohio, but also shout out to the two other people who asked about aging, Rick Clark and Deb Fuller. Deb Fuller, by the way, casually dropped that she and her husband through hiked from Key West to Mount Katahdin, I think is how you say it, which is in Maine, which according to Google Maps would take you 677 hours. So that is impressive. That's
Deb,
incredible.
You don't need our help.
Yeah, we need your help, host Deb. The podcast. Come right. Host the podcast. But Jeff was curious. He said that he was 50, but he was curious what you guys think is some of the most common myths or bad advice out there about exercising over 40 or aging over 40. I mean, he even said this in the voicemail himself, but 40 is kind of an arbitrary number, but just things you see about people getting older and how they should exercise and maybe some of the things that get passed along that are not good advice.
All I'll say is that the human body is so complex and there's still so much that we don't know about it. I think from like my perspective, putting my public health hat back on and thinking about like big epidemiological data, all that we really know is that the more that you age, the more you benefit from recovery in between hard sessions. We know very little else. So I'm going to just assume that the principles of progressive overload or specific adaptation to implied demands, meaning if you gradually push yourself at something and then rest and recover in between and then come back and push yourself again, that is going to work at all ages, knowing that for both men and women, testosterone begins to decline around, Steve might know better than me, I think like I think around 30, so well before maybe even 25, well before 40. And the reason that matters is testosterone is the hormone that really speeds up recovery. It's why it's so effective when taken as a performance enhancing drug. So that is the theoretical backing for why as you age, you might need a little bit more time to recover and adapt. But I think all these directives of you got to strength train more, you got to do more aerobic training, I think it just comes back to like move your body regularly and train for what you want to do.
So to Brad's point on testosterone dropping, my one rant is to be very careful of older individuals and influencers who just are incredibly jacked and recovering all the time and giving you advice because they're probably on testosterone.
They are doped to the gills.
They're doped to the gills. So don't listen to them.
Is Steve and I both said on the internet in separate occasions, and I saw afterwards that we'd both said it, which is that it's never the liver supplement. It's always the steroids and fill in any performance enhancing drug for the liver supplement.
Yes, it's always the steroids. So just pay attention to that. And in all seriousness, you know, I think we overcomplicate the shit out of this. If we look at the data, I mean, some people will be like, oh, you need to strength train because you lose muscle mass. As Brad said, you need to, you know, do your zone two or endurance stuff because like VO2 declines on this. Here's what we know. Everything gets worse. Everything. You know, if we're going on to 50, 60, 70, 80, everything gets worse. Relatively gradually. There are no like steep declines. It's relatively progressive. Some is more progressive than others and other things, but everything kind of gets worse. And we know this for partly because if we look at, you know, the age, like we'll just pull out 70 world records for the 100, the marathon, the 5K, guess what? Men to women, there's a little variation, but it's basically everyone's about 40% slower than, you know, the best of the best, you know, in their 20s, 30s, whatever have you. So eventually everything gets worse and comes out at about the same rate. So what is that? Where does that leave us? That means that, going back to our exercise podcast, you should do something that you can consistently do for a long period of time, all the way into your 70s, 80s, hopefully longer, that like keeps you moving. Because the one principle we know that is very clear is use it or lose it. You know, it's either easier to kind of maintain something or build it. So my two pieces of advice, if you're younger, even younger in aging, 30s, 40s, 50s, like, it's really important for you to keep the thing up, because your drop off is going to come from a higher ceiling. So you get a nice gradual decline. And if you're older, you know, the other part is like, just keep doing stuff. So I wouldn't get lost in the weeds. I would say, if you like strength training, keep strength training. If you like, you know, going on long hikes, keep doing long hikes. The biggest thing is that you keep moving. And if you do that, you're great. And then I would also say one other caveat here is that, you know, I think we often underestimate what people, especially in the early 40s, can do. And we're starting to see that, especially in the endurance community, but even in the sprint community. Because most of the high level athletes kind of retire, not because like they couldn't still be relatively competitive, but because like there's no incentive to. Like, what's the incentive for Usain Bolt to keep continuing and getting, you know, eighth at the Olympics when he's 40 versus first? There is no incentive, right? What's the point? I mean, maybe Tom Brady keeps going, but, you know, each their own. But we see this with some wonderful over 40-year-old athletes, like, you know, Sarah Hall has excelled, runner fastest ever in the marathon as she aged. I mean, I coached Roberta Groner to sixth in the world at the marathon when she was, I think, 42. And then you had sprinters like Kim Collins, who ran 9.93 for the 100, his lifetime best, when he was 40 years old. So like, I think the reason I say that is we often see 40 as this delineating part. And maybe it's because that's staring me in the face that I'm making this argument. So I'm giving myself a little hope for the future. But we also see this as like the aging part, because this is when you go to masters track and field, or masters competition is 40. But that's just, there's wiggle room there. So like, you can keep performance going at a relatively high level as long as you're using it, is my point.
A little bit on your training age. Whether or not you start to see a performance decline above 40 depends on your training age. So training ages is how long have you been doing the sport for? And if you were someone that started running or whatever your sport might be at age 20, and you were phenomenal, or you got the most out of yourself because you did it really seriously at 35, 36, then yeah, at 44, 46, 48, you might be slower. If you're brand new to sport and you're just getting into sport at age 42, you might be hitting PRs into your 50, because there's like these two curves of training, age, and experience, and then the natural decline in all the hormones that drive performance. So in terms of like measurable output on specific tasks, it ultimately depends on how long you've been doing the thing as to where your ceiling is to keep getting better.
The thing that jumps out to me, this is a little, maybe a little more woo-woo, but putting on my motivational hat, and maybe easy for me to say because I'm not quite 40, but just like, don't put limits on yourself. I think we are a very ageist society, and I think there are a lot of people out there who are older and are doing badass stuff. Deb Fuller walked from Key West to Maine. I mean, you don't hear those stories that much. And so like, go to Steve's point and the point we made earlier, like, find something that brings you joy and you enjoy, you like doing, and go see where that can take you. And don't tell yourself you can't do it because you are however old you are. You know, who knows what you can do? Only you can figure that out. So
when you came to train with me in Asheville, Clay, and we went into the gym together, and I was training my deadlift hard that day, who was the one person in the gym that was training harder than me?
Sandy.
No, Roxanne. I have two training partners, Sandy and Roxanne. But
Roxanne.
Roxanne. In hard and appropriate, right? And do you remember how old Roxanne is?
I believe 70.
She's 70. And she's in there 4 days a week training compound lifts with good form and very appropriately, but hard. Like, she takes two reps in reserve to really mean two reps in reserve, not eight reps in reserve, but two. And she's 70. So I think that when we get rid of the minutia of, you know, world-class this, world-class that, like timings and all that, yeah, push yourself. And what I would say too, we're belaboring this a bit, but if you are someone that's addicted to progress, well, then once that curve catches up to you, because like Steve said, it comes for all of us, pick a new sport. You know, get into lifting if you haven't. If you've lifted your whole life and now your lifting performance is going down, get into through hiking. Join like a ultimate frisbee league. Try a team sport. You know, I think that like there's multiple ways to roam here.
The final thing to give people hope, as I was fact checking myself while you were talking there, some of these masters records are nuts. You know, Derek Turnbull, sub 5 mile at 65 plus.
Wow.
My boy Jose Lopez, 80 plus, sub 6 mile.
Wow. 80?
80 plus, male 80, Jose Lopez in 2021. He's cranking it. 5:56 mile.
You think he's
doping? Are these drug tested? I gotta ask.
I mean, I don't know. I'm not here to hate on Jose, because you know, if he's 80 and doping, that's probably the best time you should dope anyways. I'm not condoning it, but you know, who knows?
All right, we did it. We got some voicemail. We reached into the mailbag. Hopefully we gave you guys some wisdom, but if we didn't, you still made $20. So there's that. This was great. The voicemails were awesome. I'm sure we'll answer a few more in the coming weeks. If you guys want to call and you haven't yet, the number is 646-893-9503. I think I'm going to put a moratorium on the $20 for a question that makes in the show. But I will still offer, if we use a question, I'll still offer $5 for now. If it goes in the show, I'm not saying.
Dude, we just, whoa. The outtake from the show. We just talked about how streaks and incentives work until they get in the way. Come on, listeners. You are now on the path of mastery with us. You've given us our chance. You've seen how we answer your questions. Don't call in because you want $5 for Clay. Call in because you're a part of this community, because you've got a question, you've got a topic, a prompt that you think we should explore.
Clay, our answers are worth more than $5. That's all I'm saying. You know, these people are getting value. You can't get this anywhere else.
That's true. Listeners, I'm just telling you the next part, but I'll still send you $5. 646-893-9503. All right. Thanks to everyone for listening. Thank you to you guys for giving such smart answers. Thanks to everyone who called, especially Oliver, Alex, Jeff. We will be back on Monday. It's another episode of the Coach Up. And until then, see you later.